I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Moon Choi took over the University of Missouri system during a turbulent time. In his 3 years at the helm, he's worked to increase diversity, but has seen state funding plummet. Today, we talk with President Choi about those concerns and others. We'll also learn about the university's new health initiative. It includes the construction of a $221 million facility in Columbia. Then, you know David Brooks is a commentator on NPR, PBS, and in the New York Times. It's a fascinating news day to have him join us in the studio. We'll ask him about impeachment, the Democratic presidential field, and his latest book about living a moral life. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. It's got a fancy name, the Next Gen Precision Health Initiative, but it's got an easy-to-understand mission, cutting-edge medicine. This summer, the University of Missouri launched this effort, which at its core is about predicting, preventing, and treating diseases using the most advanced tools in the world. A 268,000-square-foot facility will be built in Columbia to house this program, but all four MU campuses are engaged in the effort. At UMKC, one big push is to use big data to identify the best treatments for patients. The president of the University of Missouri System, Moon Choi, is my guest. Mr. President, what a pleasure. Welcome.
Thank you very much. Great to be here.
And just a reminder, I teach journalism up on the Hill here at UMKC. Mr. President, what distinguishes this Next Gen Precision Health Initiative from any other healthcare initiative?
So it is a mouthful, but it's the most important and the largest project in the history of the UM system. Hmm. But aside from the size of the project, this is going to be a game changer when it comes to developing life-saving treatments, developing the type of innovations with industries to create that clinical translation, whether one lives in a metropolitan area or a rural area. But lastly, it's to train the next generation of healthcare providers that serve all of Missouri.
Is this different from initiatives being undertaken in other states across the country?
Well, we're going to make this very unique based on the strengths that we have. Here at UMKC, we have many clinicians who work at the hospitals around Kansas City, working alongside our data scientists to be able to find new ways of using artificial intelligence and data analytics to quickly detect, let's say, rare forms of cancer, and then to try to find the most useful solutions based on a personalized approach that treats the individual.
How did this plan come about?
This plan came about 5 years ago when the University Board of Curators realized that the universities had to have an economic impact and had to really control the cost of healthcare. In a state like Missouri, public higher education institutions must serve as an economic engine and also helps the state when it comes to fiscal matters. Through this process, if we can reduce the cost of healthcare, reduce the cost of Medicaid, that's a benefit for the citizens in the state.
So this initiative even predates your time here in Missouri.
Absolutely, yes.
One result of this effort, Mr. President, is aimed at a big problem in Missouri, and that's slowing the opioid-related overdose deaths across the state. Mm-hmm. How much impact is it having there?
Oh, it's going to have a huge impact. Currently, there are several key faculty members at UMKC, namely Holly Hagel, as well as Rachel Winograd at University of Missouri St. Louis, who are working on these projects using both state funds and federal funds. They are looking at ways to educate, prevent, and also treat opioid victims. And according to Dr. Rachel Winograd and Holly Hagel, we have a poison crisis. It's not just an opioid addiction crisis. So we are taking this very seriously. And to be able to use advanced data analytics, they're able to identify where are the problem points. Can they identify those trends before they turn into a major problem for that region?
MU System President Moon Choi is my guest. Another result here at UMKC, scientists are focused on using big data in the treatment of heart disease.
That's right.
Tell us about what that's about.
Well, there is a spectacular cardiovascular doctor named John Spertus, who's a member of the UMKC faculty. And he, along with many of his colleagues throughout the country, have been looking at what are the conditions that people come to see him and other doctors to get treated for their heart diseases? What are their life experiences? What are their genetic makeup? What are their lifestyles and the environment that they grew up in? So having all of that data and knowing what treatments worked and what treatments didn't work, they're able to identify and pinpoint the best treatment based on the conditions that the patients have.
So you plug all that information in and out comes something that actually might be pretty effective.
Absolutely. Rather than taking a guess, it'll be more of a pinpointed solution for that patient.
There's also an effort to develop something called wearable technologies that protect against traumatic brain injury that our soldiers have suffered at war. Describe that one to us.
So this is a project that's being led by faculty members at Missouri S&T, working with the VA researchers in Columbia, along with the Mizzou faculty as well. And they're developing technologies, obviously, to protect against the concussions that can occur through a bomb blast, for example. But in addition to that, if they can actually have a wearable device that can sense small changes in the blood flow, small changes in the oxygen that goes through the parts of the brain, they're able to use that as a signal to determine if the person is susceptible for TBI, traumatic brain injury, or more long-term PTSD. Tremendous technologies.
You're building this new $221 million facility in Columbia. What's that going to look like? What's it going to do?
It's going to be a spectacular facility that's going to look very modern because the type of work is going to be modern, collaborative, interdisciplinary research. This building is going to have very few walls. We want the engineers, computer scientists, social scientists working together on developing solutions that are going to be meaningful to citizens of Missouri and beyond.
Are there any potential changes to this campus in connection with this project?
There's going to be a big change. In fact, UMKC researchers as well as administrators have been fully behind this effort. And they recognize that they bring a tremendous strength in data analytics, like the type of work John Spertus does. And we're going to be developing a center of excellence for data analytics using next-gen technologies.
And so that means a new building here at UMKC?
We are thinking of a new building, or it could be in the cloud. And so we're evaluating those options. And the University of Missouri system and the two universities, UMKC and Mizzou, will invest $5 million. We're going to be seeking philanthropic contributions on top of that and developing a partnership with industry, perhaps IBM or Dell and so forth. So what we're envisioning is about a $20 to $25 million center of excellence located right here to benefit Precision Health using UMKC researchers.
When do you plan to finalize those plans for UMKC, Mr. President?
Within a year. Within a year so that we can launch this partnership beginning at the fall of 2020 semester.
Let's turn to some other issues involving higher education here in Missouri and obviously the UM system. How is enrollment holding up across the MU system right now?
Enrollment is pretty steady. There's been a big increase in first-time college students at Mizzou. And you may recall 2 years ago, they were down to about 4,150 first-time college students. And that occurred because of the aftermath of 2015 and so forth. But this year, they're expecting almost 5,500 students. The turnaround from 2017 to now has been nothing short of being just terrific. And that occurred because of the hard work of everyone involved in attracting students, including our staff, faculty, and alums who are talking about the positive energy at the university.
People want to know if the Columbia campus has recovered from the tumult of 2015. You're suggesting the answer to that is yes.
Yes, it's a definite yes. And in that process, all of our universities are in a stronger position. And there has been a small increase in undergraduate students at UMKC this year. And the chancellor and the provost have a new emphasis to grow first-time college students. Currently, it's about 1,100. They're thinking that in a few years it could be several thousand because of the outstanding education and affordable prices that we provide.
Even that small growth is significant here because across the country, enrollments in many states are down and down significantly.
Down significantly, absolutely. And we're seeing that at especially in Missouri. And there are many four-year universities along with community colleges that are competing for students. And we're also competing for students who come from outside of the borders of Missouri as well. But that's going to continue because of the confluence of e-learning opportunities as well.
What about international students, Mr. President? There was a dip in their enrollment at one point. Is that rebounding right now?
It's rebounding very slowly. Many academic institutions rely on students from China, and the number of students from China have declined over the years.
Is that given some of the trade tensions? Is that
some of the trade tensions and perhaps some of the issues related to the rhetoric that's being used across the country? And many Chinese students are looking for other opportunities, whether it's in Australia, England, or in Europe.
And what are the hopes for that changing going forward? And do you hope the administration in Washington helps with your efforts there?
I believe that we should all be welcoming of those that want to come to our country and contribute. And the education that we provide to our students, whether domestic or international, is a high-quality one. And that didn't change over the past few years. So that's the message that we'll be sharing, that we want to train the best and the brightest using our excellent universities, not only in Missouri, but throughout the United States.
I'm wondering about the impact of Missouri Senator Josh Hawley on all this as well. You know, he's mm-hmm. been telling schools they should shut down their Confucius Institutes because he says they peddle Chinese propaganda. Mm-hmm. The institutes provide, you know, Chinese language instruction and a whole host of other services. What do you make of what he's been saying?
Well, we take the issue of academic espionage, which is at the heart of what Senator Hawley has been talking about, very, very seriously, very, very seriously. So we did a recent audit of our own Confucius Institute, and that institute, which is located in Columbia, teaches Chinese language to our students free of charge. And we found no issues of concern in that regard, no issues of academic freedom being curtailed. And so we're going to continue this partnership, but with every program that we run, we always have to have evaluations and assess the quality of the program. So we're moving forward in this regard with a trust but verify approach.
And Senator Hawley, what's his reaction to your approach to this issue?
We have not spoken directly with Senator Hawley, but we did provide some written confirmation of where our Confucius Institute stands. And based on the audit study and the quality of the programs, we will continue, but we'll also continue to monitor all of our programs, including the Confucius Institute.
MU System President Moon Choi is my guest. If you want to join our conversation here, 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date on Twitter, and we'll get you straightened out there. You know, state funding has been a struggle in recent years when it comes to higher education. This year, the state ranked 46th nationally in per capita state support for higher education. It was 45th in 2016, 17, and 18. How big a problem is that?
Well, we are becoming much more
We
are becoming much more efficient in terms of delivering our education. And part of that is because of the reduction in state funding. In real dollars, our state funding this year is same as it was in 1998. But we have 40% more students in the process. So we could all do the math and say we are becoming more efficient in that regard. And that's a good thing for students because we want to keep the cost of education low. At all four of our universities, our tuition, when we compare it to regional other universities in the region, like Illinois, for example, is significantly lower. Hmm. And we're providing great value to our students. But continuous reductions in our funding, whether it's from tuition side or the state appropriation, is going to eat into the mission of our university, our ability to perform research. That's what distinguishes us from the other universities in the state, and to use that research to help inform our teaching, vice versa, as well as the engagement that's possible with our community and the state.
But given that, how difficult is it to attract top professors to a state that doesn't value higher ed just as much as every other state in the nation? You're on a 20-year slide here, Mr. President.
Well, I believe that it is not because the state doesn't value higher ed. I believe it's one of the reasons is that there is not enough revenue to support higher ed. And as you know, we are a low-tax state, so we understand it. But given the constraints that we have, we are doing everything that we can to increase revenue, cut expenses, so that we can support our faculty members who can then perform research and teach our students to become the next generation of leaders in the state of Missouri.
You know, my sense from talking to state lawmakers for years is a lot of them don't value higher education mm-hmm. as much as perhaps they did in the past, and that contributes to this dip in state funding. How are you working with state lawmakers to sort of bring them up to speed about the work the system is doing?
So during the past 2.5 years, I've met with a great number, hundreds of legislators, to talk about issues that affect higher ed and the value that we provide to the state. Not a single legislator, whether a House member or a Senate member, has indicated to me that they don't value higher ed. What they've asked us to do, though, is to be relevant and go back to the fundamentals, which is teaching, research, and engagement, and provide the best opportunities for our students that we are educating.
What's been the impact on the number of majors you can offer and the number of professors you can employ?
Right now, the number of faculty members that we have at all four universities is about the same as it was about 5 years ago. And we're asking our faculty members to do more, in some cases with less, but also to do it in a way that doesn't take away from the quality of the programs.
Let's go to some phone calls at 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at KCUR Up to Date. Laura from Leawood. Laura, you're on Up to Date with President Moon Choi.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Yeah, go ahead, Laura.
So I have a son who will be going to college next year and, of course, wants to go to Mizzou, but we live in the state of Kansas. I graduated from UMKC. My husband graduated from Mizzou. And while you do offer some reciprocity at Mizzou, it certainly doesn't match what's at UMKC. And my question is, will you guys be doing any more to offer in-state tuition more often to people who live in Kansas who want to go to Mizzou, other than getting a 27 on your ACT or establishing residency?
Yeah, so, what about reciprocity, Mr.
Yeah,
President?
So we are constantly reviewing our scholarship strategy. In fact, we have some national leaders working with all four of our universities to see what best approaches should we use to increase the number of students attending a university from the state and out of state. So one of the best things that I can recommendations for you is to contact the Director of Enrollment. Her name is Kim Humphrey out at the Mizzou, and she can share with you all of the new programs of scholarship that's available. One of the things that I would like to share with you is that during this past year, the UM system, Mizzou, and UMKC invested $40 million for scholarships for the Kansas City region, which was matched by another $40 million from the Block Family Foundation and KC Scholars. So there are many more programs, so I would ask you to reach out to Kim Humphrey.
You know, higher education is under so much stress these days in so many quarters around the country, Mr. President. I'm wondering, is it time to rethink the university model when it comes to offering options for getting students through the core classes more quickly, maybe offering, you know, 2-year programs instead of traditional 4-year programs? What's the thinking at Mizzou on that front?
So not only Mizzou, but all four of our universities are thinking about what the future will hold. Conducting business as usual is not going to work in this new environment with such great competition from other universities, as well as challenges to our financial models that we have. So we are expanding into e-learning in a big way with all four of our universities that reduce duplication and create very innovative, high-quality programs, especially those adult learners who have some college credit but no degree. And there are 800,000 of those individuals just in Missouri. So we have to be constantly thinking about new ways of doing business. Now, at the core, universities have survived. Mizzou has been in business since 1839 because they focused on those three, teaching, research, and engagement. But beyond those fundamental missions, we have to be thinking of using new technologies and new approaches. Why not have a three-year degree in certain areas, especially when students can come into the university taking courses while they're in high school? And so there has to be innovative thinking for us to survive.
You know, one big concern that arose in the student protests at Mizzou a few years ago was the lack of diversity in the ranks of MU faculty. How is the university system progressing when it comes to increasing diversity among its student body, faculty, and staff?
That is a very important responsibility of the president, chancellors, and everyone within the university to create that welcoming environment. And we're seeing significant growth in our underrepresented minority students at all of our campuses, as well as students who come from lower socioeconomic classes. And for us, when it comes to diversity, it's so key for us to focus on the diversity of experiences, backgrounds, and perspectives, whether a person is from rural Missouri or a person who comes in with disabilities. We want to create that welcoming environment to improve the learning and research environment for the university.
You know, yeah, go ahead.
And I was just given some numbers by my colleague, and that underrepresented minority students increased 4.5% at Mizzou this year.
Hmm. Just one final point. There's a new push in California to allow college athletes there to earn money from the use of their names and images. What do you make of that?
I think it's a terrible idea.
Do you?
Yes, I do.
Why?
At the heart of this is that we have to consider that they are student athletes, and student athletes are provided significant benefits to attend the university, in some cases up to $50,000 to $60,000 a year, so that they can get an education and also perform their athletic duties on behalf of the university. When we have payment, that takes away the amateur nature of this enterprise, and it will also create those richer schools getting richer in terms of the athletic capabilities they can attract.
Right.
And it will create a hierarchical system that would not favor the competition that we enjoy in college sports.
You know, a lot of people think that the value the athletes bring far exceeds anything they get in return in the value of scholarships and the like. There's a lot of people who disagree with you.
There are many people who disagree with me, but the great majority of academic leaders feel the way that I do. But it's a good way for us to continue that conversation, because this issue is not going away.
That's University of Missouri System President Moon Choi. Mr. President, it's been a pleasure to have you here. Thanks for sharing your views.
Thank you.
I appreciate
it. Thank you very much.
After a short break, the New York Times' David Brooks joins us. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. Sign up for my weekly newsletter, Kraske Off Mic, at kcur.org/Kraske. Get my take on guests and topics from the show and highlights from the up-to-date team. All that in your inbox each Monday. Don't miss out. Go to kcur.org/Kraske and sign up now. Tomorrow, up-to-date is live from NPR headquarters in the nation's capital. We'll sit down with NPR's chief economics correspondent, that's Scott Horsley. Join us for that tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, there's no shortage of issues for David Brooks to dig into these days. On Capitol Hill, the drumbeat for impeachment of an American president grows by the day in the wake of reports that President Trump pressed Ukraine's president to investigate former Vice President Joe Biden's son. Just yesterday, Missouri Congressman Emanuel Cleaver joined the pro-impeachment fray. Meantime, Elizabeth Warren is climbing in the polls as Democrats try to find a candidate. And David Brooks has been thinking a lot about what he calls exclusive meritocracy that he says is ripping the nation apart, and how institutions like the Kansas Leadership Center in Wichita are working to counter that. David Brooks is in town to speak at the Church of the Resurrection tomorrow night. He's an op-ed columnist for the New York Times and a commentator on the PBS NewsHour, as well as NPR's All Things Considered. His latest book is The Second Mountain, The Quest for a Moral Life, and he joins me here in the studio. What a pleasure. Welcome back, David.
We've got a lot to talk about.
Yes,
wow.
Yes, we do. We've got to get going here. Well, let's start with the news, as all good journalists should, David. The Democrats are talking impeachment in the wake of the Ukraine controversy involving President Trump and Joe Biden. A transcript released this morning appears to suggest some issues. What do you make of it? Should the Democrats proceed, even though an election year looms? How do you shake it out here?
Yeah, I have a weird perspective. I do think he's worthy of impeachment based on what he said. If he's trying to get a foreign country to dig dirt on his political opponent using federal money as a leverage, that's clearly a crime. That's clearly betraying the national
interest. It's a quid pro quo, yeah.
Yeah, and so I do think he did it. I still don't think the Democrats should proceed with this, in part because it's going nowhere. To actually get him out of office, you'd have to win over 27 Senate Republicans, and that's just not going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
Second, it detracts from the presidential candidates, who I think should be the core of the Democratic Party message. Third, I don't find, and the candidates don't find, that many people out in the country are really putting this high on their agenda. They're caring about health care. They're caring about other things. And so it'll just become another political circus in D.C. that a lot of people feel alienated from and not what they want their leaders to be talking about.
So what should Democrats do then? Emanuel Cleaver here says he doesn't want his grandchildren to look at him one day and look at him as someone who didn't do anything in the wake of these developments.
Yeah, well, that's why we have an election. And I do think defeating him in the polls is what Democrats should be aiming for. If he's taken out through some impeachment process, which, as I say, will not happen, but if it did, 40% of the country would regard that as an illegitimate thing. And we no longer have a country we no longer have statesmen who are sort of objective statesmen and who don't decide based on party. Everybody votes just on party. And so the people who support Trump think this whole thing is a circus. And if he's removed and they think it's a circus, their anger will come up in some unpleasant way.
So your point is this is going to go nowhere anyway because the Senate Republicans simply won't go there.
Yeah. Right. And so, you know, the campaign has been pretty good for the Democrats. I think it's been a pretty good campaign. So if I were them, I'd want to focus the attention Trump versus their presidential candidates, not Trump versus Nancy Pelosi or Gerald Nadler.
But some might say the Republicans have an obligation to impeach and follow the same constitution the Democrats do.
Yeah, I mean, in an ideal world, people would set aside their party labels and make those decisions.
But
we don't live in that world. And secondly, an impeachment is not a criminal thing. It's a political thing. It's not like prosecuting a crime. It was designed as a political process that you could do or not do depending on what's good for the country.
Let's turn to the Democratic presidential race. David, you just wrote a column, interesting column, titled A Brief History of the Warren Presidency. In it, you forecast the possibility that Elizabeth Warren beats Joe Biden for the nomination and then Donald Trump for the presidency. And then you wrote this paragraph. The euphoria ended when Warren tried to pass her legislative agenda. One by one, her proposals failed in the Senate. Medicare for all, free college, decriminalizing undocumented border crossings, even the wealth tax. Democratic senators from red states, she learned, were still from red states. Embracing her agenda would have been suicidal. Warren and her aides didn't help. Fired up by their sense of moral superiority, they were good at condemnation, not coalition building. Why would Elizabeth Warren struggle so much with coalition building?
Well, first, there are a couple of predictions embedded in that thing.
Yes, there are.
First, that she gets the nomination. And I think that's likely right now, in part because she's a pretty good candidate. When you look at candidates, look at them like a scout looks at a pitcher, like who has the best stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And just when you watch her campaign, she's got the best stuff. People said, oh, she's not likable. She's now regarded among Democrats as the most likable candidate. And there's also an atmosphere that the whole system is corrupt and we need to do something structural about it. And so I do think she wins, but on her proposals are just outside the mainstream of where a moderate Democrat is likely to be or could be and survive politically. Taking away 180 million people's health care insurance is just not where most moderate Democrats from purple states are going to be able to be. And then when you talk to her and you watch her campaign, her whole ethos is, I fight, I fight, I fight. And that's a good ethos from the campaign trail in this kind of time. It's not a great ethos for governing. And we've learned that if you don't have a president who can really do deals and compromise and actually, build relationships with people who disagree with, you're probably not going to go very far. And so I do think Washington is polarized so much, you need somebody who's not going to reinforce that polarization, but who's going to transcend it.
Is there any way she could get that message between now and the day she would take office?
It's possible, but just watch how she campaigns. She's got an enemy, and sometimes they're the right enemies. Sometimes, in my view, they're not, but she attacks the enemy. And that's just been her mode. And whether it's her or Bernie Sanders or Joe Biden, I don't think people are going to change their fundamental mode after they're age 70.
A lot of the conventional wisdom on her is that she can't beat Donald Trump one-on-one.
Yeah, I don't think that's true. If this election is about Trump, then in my view, any Democrat could beat her. I mean, if I was a Democrat and I wanted to beat Donald Trump, which I think would be my priority number one, I'd just pick the most boring candidate. Because Trump is at 42, mm-hmm. and a guy at 42 cannot win unless he drags the other candidate down to 42 or below. Mm-hmm. And so some boring candidate with no downside would be the way I'd go. Elizabeth Warren, he could bring her down to 42. It'd be, I think, tougher for her than some of the other candidates. And I'm struck by the fact that, in my opinion, but the candidates I think were doing really well in the debates, like Cory Booker and Amy Klobuchar and Michael Bennett, they're still low in the polls.
They're in the same lane as Biden in a lot of ways.
Right, and that's yeah. I think that's my sense, that the Biden will occupy that moderate lane until it's too late for anybody to fill it. And the perversity of the primary calendar this year is California has moved up super early. And so it's a few days after South Carolina. It's right in the beginning, and it's on the same day as a bunch of big states like Texas and North Carolina. And whoever wins that is going to win. And so we will not have a long, drawn-out process the way we did with Sanders and Clinton last time.
The New York Times' David Brooks is here. He also does some work for NPR. Our phone number here, if you want to join our conversation, 816-235-2888, or tweet us at KCUR up to date. If Elizabeth Warren triumphs, you write, David, you see the Republican Party collapsing?
Yeah, I just don't think they're in a good place. I mean, they're in a demographic bad place. Their voters are older, white. I mean, if the future was a bunch of 74-year-old white males in Florida, then the Republican Party would be great. But that's not our future as a country. Second, the most important statistic to me is if you ask young people under 25, are you conservative? Only 12% say yes.
Hmm.
And it used to be like 35 or 40
That's
would
right.
say yes. So something about the last several years has made a lot of young people say, those conservatives are not me. And I think the primary issue is diversity. Young people grow up in a world where whites are the minority and there is no dominant majority. And they're used to that world and they like that world. And the Republican Party doesn't look like that world.
It's just remarkable the extent to which this president has changed our world, to use your phrase. I mean, the changes seem to stack up day after day.
Yeah, foreign policy, defense policy, trade policy, Republicans were free traders, immigration policy, Republicans for comprehensive immigration reform until about 5 years ago.
Yeah.
So it's a sign, though, if things can change in the last 5 years, they could change a lot in the next 5 years.
A couple more things from that column. You write that in the wake of the failure of two consecutive administrations, you can foresee the moderate liberals emerging as the dominant coalition with a single word platform, which is unity. Why do you think that'll prove to be so appealing?
Well, that's my wish fantasy.
Yeah.
I do think there is a split in the Democratic Party that is bigger than it looks right now. Now everybody's united against Trump. But I think as the Republicans fade in importance and become a minority party, the split between liberals and progressives will begin to seem stronger. And the difference is liberals basically think politics is a competition between partial truths. They really value compromise. They sort of moderate on economic stuff. They don't believe in revolutionary change that's going to tear apart the way corporations work, for mm-hmm. example. And so you'll begin to see, I think, that kind of split. And if you look at the country, 35% right now say they're conservative, 35% say they're moderate, and 24% say they're progressive. So that means the majority of the country is not where Elizabeth Warren is, but they could be where some yeah. future Joe Biden is.
David Brooks, again, from the New York Times, is my guest. David, talk a little bit, if you would, about your process for writing a column, because people will be curious about this. Just guessing here, but I bet you're just constantly thinking about the next one you've got to write.
Yeah, I used to like have normal human drives for food and all that, sleep. Now I just have one drive for yeah. column ideas.
Yeah, yeah.
And I sometimes think, oh, if I get hit by a bus and survive, I could get a column out of that. I had a fantasy that I won the lottery and it was not the money. Oh, I could get a column out of that. Yeah. And so the process is just relentless. What am I going to write next? What am I going to write next? But the way I write, and I tell my students this, when you're sitting at the keyboard, your paper should be 80% done. Writing is about structure and organization. So my method is I have a bunch of notebooks and say I'll have 200 pages of research, and I'll lay all my research out on piles on the floor of my living room. And each pile is a paragraph in my column. So it's only 800 words or 850, but I might have 14 piles. And the writing process is not typing into the keyboard. It's crawling around the living room, organizing my piles. And then after they're organized, I pick up a pile, write the paragraph, throw the pile in the garbage, pick up the next pile, write the paragraph. And so it's really about That's getting everything laid out. For some reason, I need to think geographically. I need to see it laid out physically on the floor for me to get the flow of what it is. Other than that, it's just a jumble.
Do you literally crawl around?
I literally crawl around. I have to do it on a rug or else my knees would bruise.
Now, there's an image for all of us.
Yeah, sorry about that. Sorry about that. But and sometimes when I'm organizing my piles, thoughts are coming to me, and I'm scribbling on Post-it notes and putting it here, putting it there. And if you don't have the organization and structure right of any piece of writing, it's not going to flow, and it's just not going to work.
You know, as someone who's written columns in my life, the pressure, it seems to me, on a columnist for the New York Times is that, man, you've got to come up with something fresh and new nearly every time out of the gate. I mean, some might call that real pressure.
Yeah, the first 6 months on the job were super, my hardest part of my life professionally. In part because it is pressure. I felt like you feel like you're flailing away. And in part because the paper's readers are more progressive than I am. I'm sort of moderate. And so I remember deleting my email back in those days, and there were something like 290,000 emails over the first 6 months.
Oh, my gosh.
And the core message was, Paul Krugman is great, you stink. And so they were all hitting me from the left. And I'd never been hated on a mass scale before. And, of course, those people don't really know me, but it's still stung, especially because people who write in are not only hateful sometimes,
yes,
they're effectively hateful. Mm-hmm. They pick the thing you're actually kind of insecure about and they poke into it. So they're not sociopaths. They have emotional intelligence. They use it to bad ends.
I gather that's changed over the years?
No, it's gotten worse.
And seriously?
I find that the tone of the commentary, not just on me, but everybody who's in this business, has gotten much nastier. And I would say the stuff the women who are writing face is much worse than anything a man faces. They get unbelievably repulsive messages sent to them, which are just sexual harassment in verbal form.
So the ideas then come from where? I mean, I imagine everywhere, but are there certain places you go?
Yeah, sometimes, I'm always trying to interview people. I'm going to interview people around here in Kansas City today. So I'm always trying to meet somebody, and then it's always, what's the most interesting thing that happened to me this week? Mm-hmm. Some days, you know what you got to write about it. I'm writing tomorrow a column. It has to be about impeachment. There's a rule in journalism that what do people want to read Monday morning? They want to read about the football game they saw Sunday afternoon. So you got to sort of try to be on the news. But then I try to step back as often as I can, because I think our conversation is over-politicized and under-moralized. We talk too much about every poll and not enough about the things that really matter, how to have a good relationship, how to do forgiveness, how to make suffering a source of goodness in your life and something you can learn from. And those are the things that's 90% of our life, but we in the media spend only 10% of the time on that, and we spend 90% of the time on the 10% that's politics.
So then as you think about impeachment and a column there, how does the moral living thing play into that?
Yeah, of course. I do think it, you want character is everything to me. I've written now two books in a row on character.
Right.
And so character is destiny. And I wrote a book called Road to Character in 2015 on humility. And then 2016 happened and Donald Trump rise. And I thought, oh, well, I solved that problem. We've become humble. So I do think at the end, and Trump's character has been his downfall or will be his downfall.
816-235-2888 is our phone number here for David Brooks. You can tweet us at KCUR up to date. I should point out that David Brooks will be speaking about the quest for a moral life 7 o'clock Thursday evening out at the Church of the Resurrection in Leawood. The event is free, 7 o'clock Thursday evening out in Leawood at the Church of the Resurrection. Let's go to some phone calls for David Brooks here. Frank from Lawrence. Frank, you're on up to date. Good morning.
David, I watch you every Friday with Mark Shields on the NewsHour. My question is, you just mentioned your students. Can you please talk about what you teach and where you teach and how often that happens? And I'll take your answer off the air. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks, Frank.
Thank you. Well, I'm on leave now, but I've been teaching for the past, on and off, for 13 years at Yale.
Yale, yeah.
Because I only teach at schools I couldn't have gotten into.
Makes you feel better.
Yeah, no, that's my form of revenge.
Yeah.
And I love it because being around any college campus lifts you up.
Boy, doesn't it ever.
And the kids are asking the big questions. They're morally very passionate. I think sometimes they're terrified. They put too much pressure on themselves. But they're just better than – it's not like I didn't know – it's not only that I wasn't as good as they are at what they do. I didn't know anybody as good as they are at what they do.
Yeah,
and so the meritocracy has gotten so high pressure, but the kids who succeed in it are amazing. And so I do that for community in my newspaper column. There's no face at the other side of it.
Mm-hmm.
I give a speech. There are a lot of people in the audience. I don't really know them. But when I teach a class for 14 weeks at least, I've got a community of 20.
Yeah.
And they become friends. And I was doing my office hours at a restaurant between 9 and 1 in the morning. And we'd get 15 kids and we'd just hang out. And yeah. To me, it was always more fun hanging out with them than with the faculty.
Yeah, there you go. Let's go to Macy from Fort Leavenworth. Macy, good morning to you.
Good morning. My statement is, it sounds like we're not even entertaining having Bernie Sanders on the ticket. And believe me, I would like to have a woman in the White House. We don't really necessarily need another older white male in there. But is Bernie Sanders just too punk rock to be on the ticket?
Which is too Ramones. No, I don't. I'm making a projection of what I think based on the moment. And we have a tendency to overreact to the trend of the moment. And at the moment, Warren is really rising and has been doing so for about 3 or 4 months. And Sanders is not. So, but, you know, this thing will have a lot of twists and turns. So it very much could be him too, and I don't mean to say that, you know, I'm the guy who wrote 16 million columns a few years ago saying, "Don't worry, Donald Trump will never be the Republican yes. nominee for president." So what do I know?
We all did, David. Right. Yeah. Your latest book, just to go with the moral living thing for a moment, The Second Mountain: The Quest for a Moral Life, talks about a simple concept: the joy of offering gifts to others. What are you talking about there?
Yeah, well, I've been through a bad period in my life, in around 2013. My marriage had ended. My kids were leaving home. I'd lost a lot of my friends because my friends used to be conservative movement, and I'm no longer really in that.
Yeah.
And so I went through this dark period. We all go through these dark periods. But I learned something. You know, you learn things in the valleys of life. And one thing I learned is that you can be broken by suffering or you can be broken open. And some people build up a shell and they become impenetrable. And some people open themselves up wide and they discover their heart and soul. Things that, frankly, a lot of us men sort of repress, some mm-hmm. of the emotions that we repress, and the yearnings for goodness which emanate from our soul. And so when you've been down in the valley and you've discovered your ability to care, you're ready for a larger life. I have a friend who told me that when her daughter was born, she found she loved her more than evolution required.
Huh.
And I've always loved that. Wow. Because some things we do to pass along our genes,
yeah.
But some things we do because we just are human and we have an ability to care that is inexplicable in earthly grounds.
Yeah.
And so the book is about how people lead morally transformed lives.
In another recent column, you talk about the exclusive meritocracy, where prestige is defined by how many people you can reject. What's the problem with the exclusive meritocracy in this country as you see it, David?
Well, in that case, it's a lot of universities who they brag about how low their admit rate. Oh, we're only admitting 5%. They should call that the reject rate. Why are they rejecting 95%? Why are you hurting people? But that's built on what's a bigger trend, which is our meritocracy is based on a couple lies. The first lie is that career success can make you happy.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm the poster child for that's not true. The second, life is an individual journey. You need to shed everybody else and just on your way to success. The third is, I can make myself happy. It's an individual thing if I just lose 15 pounds or get better at yoga. But when you talk to people on their deathbed, when they talk about the happiest moments, they weren't self-sufficient.
Right.
They were utterly dependent on others.
Yeah.
And then the most destructive lie, which we don't tell but we actually do with our actions, is that people who achieve more in a career sense are worth more than other people. And if you want to tear apart a society, that's a pretty good lie to tell.
And you point out in this column that much of the country, in fact, is heading in the opposite direction. You cite two examples worth talking about here. One is Arizona State University, which I didn't realize this, which you say defines itself not by how many kids it can exclude, but by how many people it includes. Tell us about Arizona State.
It's led by a man named Michael Crow, who's been president there for like 20 years. And he is just always wants more. And he said, if people need education, my job is to give as many people an education as I can. And he's managed to like quadruple the number of first-generation kids who go there, quadruple the number of people in engineering schools. The school is gigantic, but when I spent 3 or 4 days there, people didn't feel like they were being run through a machine. It still felt like a school to them. And they're so big, their honors college is bigger than all of Stanford. As they say, they graduate more Jews than Brandeis and more Muslims than Jews. They just have big numbers. But the quality, as this is happening, the quality of the school has radically increased.
That just strikes me as akin to a higher education miracle because, again, the conventional wisdom is the bigger you get, the worse it gets.
Yeah, and but and all the rankings, U.S. News and all those kind of rankings, the amount of money spent on research has quadrupled.
Wow.
And they just have – he's a dynamic leader who's found a million new ways to do stuff. And they're also – they're not in an ivory tower. They're – the School for Public Policy is in a homeless shelter. So they're integrated into the community, into Phoenix and Tempe and the other areas around there. And it just feels unlike any other university I've been to.
There's also you took a look at something closer to Kansas City. It's the Kansas Leadership Center in Wichita, which believes that anyone can lead anytime. Again, this is the opposite of exclusivity. What impressed you about it? And Ed O'Malley, who runs the center down there, has been on the show any number of times.
Yeah, yeah. I loved my visit there a couple of weeks ago. And what impressed me is you go in and they're teaching people how to be leaders. And there are CEOs in the room. But there are also people with mental disabilities in the room. There are teenagers in the room. There are homeless people in the room. And their mantra is that leadership is not a position. It's an activity. And that everybody can be a leader. Everybody can change their organization or their community in their own way.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's very egalitarian. And they give people precise names for certain things that commonly happen in an organization. So, for example, sometimes you need to turn up the heat to create change.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes you need to turn down the heat to create reconciliation. So they give you a vocabulary, like you're in a meeting, suddenly everybody's angry. You just think, oh, we're just turning up the heat. It's normal. We don't have to panic here.
Yeah.
We can just figure out we're turning up the heat for a reason. And and so it's a way to do organizational change. I've got this thing at the Aspen Institute I run called Weave, the Social Fabric Project, where we go out and celebrate weavers, people who are building community, transforming lives. And KLC was certainly their weavers extraordinaire.
That's interesting. Bowen from Brookside. I'm short of time. Bowen, go quickly if you would.
David Brooks, I love your work. I just read your new book, Second Mountain. In it, you talk about your own, in a sense, conversion experience to recognizing the importance of working for the service of the common good. Don't you think Elizabeth Warren, even at the age of 70, could recognize she might have to make some adjustments to be able to do that?
It's possible. No, I believe in redemption. I believe in change. We all change through life. And so it's possible. And she could say, you know, I've got to get along with Republicans if I'm going to pass anything, because that's the legitimate truth. You're going to have to get along with Republicans. And I salute anybody who runs for president. I hang around these politicians, and they're good people by and large. They're stuck in a rotten system.
Yeah.
But by and large, I find them very – they're in it for the right reason, because it's just not that glamorous to be a member of Congress.
Yeah.
I fly out of D.C. on Thursdays when they're all going home, and they're all on the plane again coming home every Thursday. Senators in first class, the House members back in the back. But you know, all that travel, all that fundraising – you wouldn't do it unless you thought you were trying to do some good.
Absolutely. David Brooks, again, The Quest for a Moral Life speaks Thursday evening on that topic at the Church of the Resurrection out in Leawood. The event is free. His latest book, The Second Mountain, The Quest for a Moral Life. What a pleasure to have you here in town. Enjoy your stay.
Thank you. It's a great pleasure to be here.
Tomorrow on the show, we broadcast live from Washington, D.C., and we're going to check in with some of the most visited institutions in our nation's capital. That's its museums. Our show is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Elizabeth Ruiz, and Jamie Hobbs. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.